Sullivan that's carrying that extra weight. And it's counted there. Right hand. Flattened. Fitzgerald, who's going to struggle to beat this count. He's all over the place. He's absolutely gone. And O'Sullivan is celebrating a first round stoppage.
To many, boxing remains the sweetest science. To others, it's a barbaric abomination, littered with shady scoundrels and snake oil promoters. But at its heart, you'll still find honest-to-the-core fighters scrapping for a living. From the age of 9, when he took on and defeated a Welsh 11-year-old in Swansea, Gary Spike O'Sullivan was made for the ring. Now, in his 37th year, he believes he's a better fighter than ever, and a world title shot remains in his eyeline. Ahead of his first bout in 16 months, we thought it was time for a proper Examiner Sport chat about that 655 square foot living, breathing organism that is the professional boxing ring, the true house of pain. It's worth an hour of your time, even though recording it took a while longer. Thank the bloody pandemic for that. Gary Spike O'Sullivan, I want to start with your most recent fight, and you're going to say, okay, Mongoya beaten in the 11th round in January, but I don't know whether it's Friday Night Lights or whatever it is, but I've always had a fascination with Texas. Like, how did you end up fighting in Texas against Mongoya? It was in San Antonio, wasn't it? Yep. Just give me the background to how that came about.
I'd initially signed a 3-fight junior middleweight contract with Golden Boy Promotions, and I had one of those fights, and then they came to me, would I fight the world champion, junior middleweight world champion, or light middleweight as we call it in Europe.
Yeah,
they call it junior middleweight in the States. So I agreed straight away, but the thing was, they told me I wouldn't be fighting for the world title, that he was moving up to middleweight, so he was vacating the light middleweight world championship, right. So they wanted me to move back up to middleweight as well with him. It would suit him, of course, he'd be the bigger man. But I agreed because it was a magnificent opportunity and magnificent stadium.
Yeah.
Would be the best arena I'd have ever fight in. Like, or not many people get to headline a show on a 64,000-seater stadium. It's the stuff of dreams, you know, since I was a kid. So,
did you like Texas?
Texas was lovely. Yeah, the people were lovely there. Very scenic place. Where we were staying anyway was, there was rough parts too, actually. Myself and Pascal Collins, my trainer, my coach, we went over initially about a month before the fight for our press conference, or maybe 2 months before, 3 months, I can't remember now. It was quite a bit before the fight, we went for press conference in Texas, and so we were obviously in training camp at the time as well. And we got up out of our hotel and we went for a run the next morning, because I needed to be training, like. But we went down a pretty rough place, you know.
This was in San Antonio now, wasn't it? Yeah,
a lot of drugs there and stuff like that, you know. You could see it, like, the houses were look rough. I think I seen a lady in her 50s with one litre cans of beer. It was about, I don't know, 8:30 in the morning, 7:30 in the morning, I can't remember, it was quite early anyway. But there he was, drinking a 1 litre can of beer, like, that time of the morning, like.
And I can imagine as well, Spike, even in January, I mean, San Antonio could be quite humid, is that right? Would it have been warm at the time?
Yeah, I think it was quite warm. Not as warm, obviously, as it would have been in the summer, like, but it was warm enough. But, you know, I fought in many places all around the world, and I never leave any of that, distract me. I just, the mind over matter were everything.
Yeah.
I fought in Quebec one time, it was minus 30 chill breeze, was unbelievable. But I enjoyed every moment of all those things, experiences in life, and it's great to experience it. And I wouldn't care, like, I'd fight out in the minus 30 in my underpants or out in the Vegas in the desert. It doesn't bother me. I just,
and, like, explain to me, because I'm fascinated, like, everything in would have been against you. I mean, we talk about in all sports home court advantage, you know, fighting in, you fought in Neptune Stadium, so you know what it's like to have it. So when you're going to Texas and you're literally going to somewhere you've never been before, and your entourage is probably, one, you know, the only thing that's supporting you. Like, how difficult, how steeper does that make the task?
I relish that, you know, but I have to give a couple of lads from Cork a shout out. They came to the fight, like, as well. And there's actually good Irish contingent in Texas, believe it or not, and there was a good few Irish came as well, but obviously they were outnumbered significantly by the Mexicans, you know. Sure. San Antonio practically is Mexico, but I relish those occasions. The harder the task, the better for me. I love that.
Yeah, because I was just going to say, I mean, and we're going to talk about several examples. It's as if, like, all boxers and all sports people obviously relish a challenge. But it seems to me like that if there's an extra little twist of a challenge, if there's an extra little obstacle involved, you seem to have this bring it on mentality. Is that fair?
I'd say that's fair to say, yeah. I said one time, which is true, like, you know, I'd have loved to go to Kazakhstan and fight Gennady Golovkin, you know, he was the man at the time. And
bee's knees, yeah.
Yeah, I said that and I meant that, like, 100%. I would love it. Would have been a massive challenge, but obviously he'd had a big crowd again, and I would love him to go to Kazakhstan and fight him there, or maybe Canelo Alvarez when he was a little bit smaller in Mexico. You know, I'd have fought them all, you know, no problem.
Yeah, and are you not concerned, or does your mind not start to play tricks? Like, people who are away, they're talking about, oh, well, the home guy's going to get the advantage. The refs are going to be obviously seeing him more than me. So I need to actually even win by more. Like, does those things not start actually trying to, you know, say to yourself, this isn't going to work out for me?
No, I always very confident. I always believe I'd win every single fight I've ever had, or anyone I've ever challenged. I always believe I can win. Mm. I was very confident and believe in myself. And now I do know, most of the time in all my big fights, I've been in the away corner and had to go to their backyards. You know, every single champion I fought like that, I actually fought them in their own backyards.
That's
and,
right.
And another thing was they were all bigger men than me as well, because I'm a late middleweight myself and they were all middleweights. But I always still believed I could win the fights.
Mm.
I didn't always, but I won a lot of them. But,
explain to the uninitiated like myself, light middleweight is 154 pounds, yeah. Middleweight is 160 pounds. And you think to yourself, that's not even half a stone, it's 6 pounds. Can it actually make that much of a difference? And does it make that much of a difference?
It does. The thing is, they're much bigger men than other. It's in high quality athletes like that, you know. It's like my father said to me before, I made a great point. For example, if you take a racehorse, a magnificent animal with 4 incredibly powerful legs, if you put 2 pounds on a horse like that, he could lose a race. But I'm only a human being, we're only with 2 small legs, not near as powerful as a racehorse. You know, 6 pounds is a massive difference. But the thing as well in boxing is the rehydration afterwards. They're bigger men, so they rehydrate more. When I fought Lemieux, for example, in Las Vegas, he was on the night 18 or 19 pounds heavier than me. You know, it's absolutely...
How come?
Just a bigger man and...
But he still had to be 160 or less.
Yeah, on the day of the weigh-in. Like, but I didn't have to dehydrate or anything. I can make a middleweight easily the majority of the time. Like,
yeah.
If I had a proper training camp, which I did for that, I made it very, very easily. I was able to have a cup of coffee in the morning before the weigh-in, you know, whereas he was in hot baths, Epsom salt baths, and in the sauna. I was when I fought in Quebec, he fought that night also. He fought Buddy Joe Saunders that night. I remember him distinctly crawling like a slug out of the sauna. He used to struggle to make weight so much. Very, very big for middleweight. But as I say, he came into the ring then. Yeah, I think he was about 12 stone 9 when we weighed in the day before, 11.6 or something like that. No, he was definitely 18 or 19 pounds heavier than me anyway.
Wow, okay. I'm going to come back to that fight. I know you mightn't like talking about it, but I'm going to come back to it afterwards. I mean, just 34 professional fights over a long career. You've won 30.
Yeah.
The 4 you've lost have been against world champions, either had been or would be in the future.
Yeah.
Were you born to be a boxer?
Jeez, I don't know. I often thought before every fight, I was in the dressing room before I came on, I think, what am I doing, you know, why am I even boxing, you know, I don't know.
Explain that to me, Spike, what do you mean?
Well, I don't know, it's a mad sport, like, you know, and you're heading out for a fight, like, and these killers, like, you know, you're thinking, bloody hell, what am I doing, like, you know, it's a tough, mad sport, like, you know,
yeah.
It's I think people have experienced white collar events, you know, the it's kind of the same feeling almost because they're going up against someone of their own ability, and I think they'll all tell you the nerves before they leave the dressing room for a fight is like nothing else. Like, it's not like playing a football match or a hurling match or anything like that. It's just it's a different type of adrenaline you kind of get into. It's a fight, you know, it's mad. But my dad introduced me to boxing when I was very, very young, and I probably started training from the age of five. So I was reared with it, and you know, I loved playing all sports, so soccer and hurling and everything. But it was the door I was kind of shown and, you know, encouraged more toward it, I feel. So that's why I done it. And, you know, I actually opened an amateur boxing club in Mahon with my parents and my brothers when I was 18, and I was expecting my first daughter at the time, and I thought I might never even box again, to be honest. At that point, I didn't do much boxing along myself for 5 years. I was doing more coaching, you know, coaching all the kids down in Mahon, and it was great. Actually, I got great rewards. A lot of coach guys, 13 kids there from Mahon, they'd never boxed previous, coaching, become national champion. It was great sense of
achievement,
like, brilliant, like seeing the kids, you know, progress and become so fit and get such good shape, and you know, because down in Mahon as well, like, you know, it's a tough enough area, you know, and it's great to. It was very enjoyable, very rewarding.
I want to go back though to that kind of primal fear thing that you mentioned, because, like, I did a very small bit of boxing in Tralee, I remember, and when I was actually the year I was doing my leaving cert, so I was about 17 or 18. And one of the things that actually sticks in my head, I was in the ring, and it was only a sparring thing one night. And you know the way we used to see in cartoons, you know, when someone gets a box and you see the stars over their head and you kind of think, you know, but you never actually realise until you're on the receiving end that you do actually see stars. Well, at least I saw stars. And ever after that, I was always wary. You know, that one incident kind of stuck in my mind. Like, so when you talk about that fear, like, it's not like any other individual sport. It's not like golf. It's not like snooker. It's not like tennis. You know, you're going in to a ring, and apart altogether from the fact that there's maybe 20,000 people in the ring, the main fear is to your own personal well-being.
I always feel I'm always prepared very well, and I feel very physically strong and capable of defending myself. But it's my fear more is of losing. You know, I'm very competitive. I think most top sports people are very competitive, streaking them, and it's more so the fear of losing and being embarrassed, maybe, you know, and getting outdone, you know, and a fight is very, bravado, masculine thing, and you don't want to lose, you know.
So, are you saying so you're less worried about your jaw and more worried about your pride?
Yeah, definitely. I don't worry about my jaw or anything. I've had my ribs broken. I broke my hand, broke my nose so many times. I can't remember how many, probably about 14. But no, I don't worry about any of that really much.
Yeah.
I've had my eardrums burst 4 times. No, you recover from all that. Like, it's grand. You'll be fine. Like, you will recover. Like, it's like my daughter was playing Gaelic football a while back now with this lockdown, but she's 8, you know. It was a good life lesson for her, and I discussed it with her again yesterday. You know, she banged heads with another girl, and, you know, it was quite a bad bang because she got a black eye instantly. And my partner was there with me, and she was like, "We'll bring her home," you know, because Ashley, my daughter, she was crying, and she wanted to go home, you know. But I said, "No, love, you know, calm down. We're going to go into the bar. We're down the bars, hurling football club. We'll get a bit of ice, pull on your eye. You'll be fine. Go out and play the next match. It was a blitz. We're having another match." So she did, and she played the next match, you know, and it's a story I can go back to with her now for many years to come. I'll say, well, remember that time you thought you couldn't do it, you know, but you went back out and played the game again.
Did you ever fear for your life in the ring? Have you ever been on the receiving end where you think to yourself, like, I mean, I need to get out of here?
Yeah, the one time was actually against Chris Eubank Jr. when I fought him in London.
2016, I think 15 or 16, I think.
2015, yeah. What was it? I think it was the third time I'd got my eardrum burst, but I first got a burst against Billy Joe Saunders in 2013. Then I was sparring a Cuban guy, and he was my eardrum in sparring. And when I fought Eubank, he bursted too, but I got a very bad pain in my head with that particular bursting of the eardrum was much worse, and he was more relentless as well, and different style of fighter to Saunders, and he was relentless in his attack, and I felt like my head was going to explode. The pressure was unbelievable, my balance was off, and you know, I never would have pulled out. Like, I'd have kept fighting, but I'm lucky that I've got a compassionate trainer, and you know, he cares about his fighters. And
Bastille,
great guy, great man. You know, he cares about his fighters, and more than, you know, going on and trying to win a fight and get the welt or whatever. And he pulled me out, and he made the right decisions. You know, not many fighters, I think, will kind of admit to that. Like, you know, they say he should have let me go on and whatever. But he made the right decision. And the fight after that, Eubank's next fight, he fought another friend of mine, Nick Blackwell. He brain damaged Nick Blackwell badly, and he's never going to recover for his life. You know, so that was the very next fight.
Yeah,
he's never going to be right. Yeah, you know?
Because that's what I'm thinking of when you said a few minutes ago to me, Spike, you know, look, you'll always recover. I'm thinking you have to admit, like, boxing is littered with stories of guys who did not recover, and some paid the ultimate price, like, in terms of with their lives. So, you know, it's a it must be at times, that ring or whatever the dimensions of it are, it must be a lonely spot on occasions.
It is. My experience in the amateurs was where, if you weren't fully fit, it's the loneliest place then, because you've nowhere to go, nobody to sub for a substitution. You're in there and that's it. You know, if you're not fully fit, you're fucked.
Yeah.
You know, you're gonna get a bin, like, you know.
Yeah.
But as a professional, I've always been very fit for all my fights. Although, I'm thinking back, one particular fight I fought Fitzgerald in the Tree Arena in Dublin, and
Anthony, is he?
Yeah. I wasn't fully fit for that fight because I actually lied to my trainer at the time as well. It's something wrong with my quad. I pulled my quad doing a squat in the Mardik. I just started training in the Mardik, and I wasn't, you know, used to doing strength and conditioning, like, basically. So I pulled, it's kind of tore me quite a bit.
Yeah.
But I couldn't pull out the fight because I knew with the hostility and the man that I was fighting, I was saying all along I was afraid to fight him, which was complete shit. Like, I was never afraid to fight anybody. That's one thing, you know, right? Never afraid, like, to fight. But I couldn't run, so I'd be telling my manager Pascal, he'd say, "Ah, did you run this morning?" I'd be like, "Yeah, I did. Yeah. Did you run? Didn't I? Oh, I did. I never ran. I couldn't run."
Yeah.
But I just went and done about two or three mile runs just for psychological
hobbled
to myself. I was thinking, just to be say I done my running, you know, which I didn't, like, but. Yeah,
it was good, so that you took him out in the first round that night.
Yeah, it was. Pascal said that to me as well. He said, like, you were lucky you really took him out in the first round that time, as your fitness mightn't be there as it went on. But I trained very hard, like, in sparring and on the punch bag, you know, so I felt like I was fairly fit, but I didn't get my road work in for that fight. I couldn't.
Yeah. One of the things you see very often, Spike, on social media, and I'm thinking of that Fitzgerald fight, like, when you actually took him out in the first round, and I remember there was an Andy Lee one as well, where he took a guy out, like, with an absolute, like, haymaker. Like, the satisfaction of that, I mean, I'm presuming, like, people talk about other sports, about a footballer catching it on the sweet spot. I imagine the satisfaction of taking somebody out with a punch like that. Is that something, would that be a fair comment? It must be huge for a boxer.
There and then, like, you'd be elated, like, and I suppose a sense of relief, really. You know, the fight's over, like, and you've won. You know, you're not going to get beat this time, you know, so. I'm not really into hurting fellas, like, you know, and so, just be glad you won the fight,
yeah.
You know. I never said this at all, really, to hurt anybody. You know, really.
Yeah, but no, but I suppose I'm less thinking of the hurt thing, and I'm more thinking of who's watching that fight. And so some promoter or Sky or HBO is kind of saying, "Hey, look, this guy can sell some tickets. He can put bums on seats."
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you're right there. Yeah, spectacular knockouts are right, definitely. they help your career along, like, you know, to get you to bigger fights. Actually, in fact, that particular night, I was a free agent. Like, yeah, I was actually I actually had a fight in Boston. Prior to that, I fought a guy called Jose Medina, a Mexican guy, very tough, on short notice, and that was kind of a trial fight. I think Golden Boy Promotions were actually promoting that fight along with my my promoters, Golden Boy and Murphy's Boxing. Murphy's Boxing would be a smaller promoter, Ken Casey from The Rock, Keith Murphy's.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm still with them and will be today I retire. You know, they've always been very good to me and I've got a great relationship with them. And, you know, but I took that fight kind of on trial. And I think what they didn't really look into enough was I took it on very short notice, but I suppose they expect professionals to be staying ready and in the gym. Something I haven't always done in my career. And, you know, I wasn't in shape for that fight, but I took it anyway because of the opportunity. And so I went there, but I had a brawl with a man. Like, there was not much skill at all involved. Like, you know, we were like nearly in a bar room brawl. Like, beat the shit out of each other for the duration of the fight. It was hard. Like, but I remember it was hot over there, and I was dehydrated, and I felt like shit. I remember going into this, I'd come back after the first round, my gum shield, I was so dehydrated, it was stuck to my gums, like, I felt fucking dry out, like, and I was bollocksed. Pastor kept me going and motivated me to go and fight another round, and bite down the gum shield, and I won the fight. It was a tough one, like.
Points,
yeah.
Yeah. 12, would you go 12?
No, it was only 6 rounds.
Oh, 6 rounds, okay.
Thank God, fuck it. I definitely would have got a banger right there if it was 12.
Yeah.
She's after the fight, I felt a bit dehydrated. I remember I had a tightening on my chest, actually, a bit of a cramp, like, it was just through dehydration. Like, I thought I was getting a banger, like, and I said to myself, I had a meeting with myself, as I like to say, like, I said, fuck it, I said, I'm not going boxing no more, because there was no agreement for a fight purse, and I wasn't sure what I was getting. It was just kind of a trial, and the amount of money was an embarrassment, like, and I thought to myself, jeez, I've kids at home, like, I nearly died here tonight for that money, and what I'm going back was an embarrassment. I'm done with boxing, I was thinking, but again, like, just maybe it was my destiny. You know, to box, Pascal, my trainer, he called me up again and said, sorry, the only fight, I hadn't said that to him at this stage, like, but I was contemplating just packing in, and he said to me, which was the one fight probably could lure me out of my own self-retirement, he said, will you fight Anthony Fitzgerald, who had been harassing me for 5 years, saying I didn't have the balls to fight him, and blah, 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 which was, as I said before, was never the case. But he was a good boxer himself, actually, like, and, you know, you couldn't be guaranteed to win. It was a 50-50 fight when we were going into the fight. Like, I mean, he'd taken Andy Lee the distance and hassled the damn the guy to beat Andy Lee. He was a good fighter, Anthony Fitzgerald, and but as I say, but the one fight probably I felt like I needed to.
Was it because it was personal?
Yeah, it was personal, that one.
Yeah.
He was being very personal and his insults, like, taking it too far, I think, you know. So yeah, I felt like I needed to deal with that. So I agreed to that fight, and also it was on Sky Sports, which appealed to me because I'd always grown up watching Sky Sports, and I'd never had the opportunity to fight in Sky, so I thought, magnificent, I'd love it, I love that. So I fought him and I knocked him out, knockout of the year 2014.
I remember it.
Yeah.
You were actually even up on the ropes before the ref had even counted him out.
That's right, yeah, I knew he was gone, it was a hard punch. You know, I actually did a bet on that one as well. 50-1 first round knockout. I put 100 quid in. It was nice bonus myself.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Jeez. But I always liked Eddie Hearn a lot. Great respect from. I was going very well with him, and I remember at the time he signed two of my stable mates. I think they're still with him actually. Luke Keeler and John O'Carroll. They were in my gym at the time, and same gym as myself at the time, and they both fought in the car. But he said Eddie Hearn said to my trainer Pascal. He said, look, after that knockout, I won't be able to get anyone in the UK to fight Spike. You're best off going to America trying to get him fights out there.
Why? Why wouldn't you get anyone in the UK?
It was just the fashion. I knocked him out, and, you know, it was pretty devastating.
You mean people are kind of going, hey, we don't want our boy in the ring with Spike?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, okay.
You know, at that very time, like, it's just, you know, I suppose, like, a striker, if he's banging in 3 or 4 goals, like, and doing magnificently, everyone wants to sign him, but he mightn't turn out to be the best in the end. Like, but at that time, I had that spectacular knockout, and Eddie Hearn, he said, geez, I think you need, I'd like to sign him, like, but I think he'd be just sitting on the shelf here in the UK and in Ireland, so you need to try and bring him to the States or whatever. Fortunately for me, that night, another twist of fate, of luck for me. During the quarter of an NFL, there was an advertisement or Rampage Jackson and some woman, they were talking about my knockout, and because there was a stool thrown at me after the fight, and it made for great TV, and
you know, with a lot of eyes on it. A
lot of eyes on it, yeah.
Yeah.
And then that's how I think, well, after that knockout, I had the fight with a Mexican prior to that and didn't really shine, you know, as I said, wasn't really fit. Came in short notice in the fight and cutting weight and didn't look the bee's knees. But I did then in the Fitzgerald fight, and Ken Casey actually, he did like my fight against the Mexican, the Golden Boy, or, you know, the Mecca of boxing, I suppose. And
yeah, Oscar De La Hoya.
Yeah, they didn't really see the potential in me. I think, as I said, they probably expected all fighters to be staying fit and coming in, and maybe they thought that was all I had at that time, which went on to prove not to be the case. But Ken Casey liked my barroom brawl style fight, and then he seen the Fitzgerald fight, and that kind of, he said, bloody, we'll bring him back again. So I got another opportunity to go back and kind of got a bit of a trial again with Ken, and it was great. I fought in a lovely stadium in where is it, Melrose in Boston. Class. It was like a scene from The Gladiator. Such a cool place. It was smaller, obviously. It was a small place. It was class, though. The ring was in the middle, and it was like a circle of seats, like,
yeah, kind of high, going up high. Yeah,
not that high, really, right. But like, it was similar to Gladiator kind of setting, you know.
Yeah,
it was class, and I fought there, and I knocked the guy out, and I had two fights within a couple of weeks. I'd stay away from my family actually that time for 6.5-7 weeks. Jeez, it was tough, but I had two fights in that space of time, and to see how I got in, and if I done well, they'd sign me, you know. And my next one was brilliant, Madison Square Garden, and it was great, like, to fight there. And
the mecca of boxing, yeah. Really, like,
yeah, I won my knockout, so I won my two fights by knockout, and they signed me then. But like, it was good, and then
they signed you to a 3-fight deal, I think.
At like, that time, I can't remember now, to be honest. The Golden Boy Promotions signed me and re-signed me continuously, rolling contracts for the last few years. But I can't remember the initial contract with Ken Casey. Like, I can't remember what it was, to be honest. But I remember fighting him at Madison Square Garden. It was great. Like,
yeah,
I was often thinking, if I ever wrote a book, maybe possibly Mahon to Madison. You know, I'm from Mahon to Madison Square Garden. Like, I was there anyway. I bought this tracksuit. I'd say bloody Ali G or one of these guys, they wouldn't wear it. Like, it was a white fur tracksuit with gold and all that, and like gold shoes. And anyway, up to my bedroom the night of the fight, I was going to wear them going to the fight, like, and I put them on, and I looked in the mirror. I goes, oh jeez, nah, I can't do it, fucking hell's too much, right? So I just took them off again downstairs. There was a couple of fighters in the lobby, and we were going being picked up and being brought to Madison Square Garden, which was very close by to our hotel anyway. And I got a text from Dermot O'Sullivan, you know.
Dermot, in the Cork hurler?
The Rock, yeah. So we're good buddies. But he says to me, geez, just as I ride down the lobby, I was getting on the lift, I looked at my phone, he says, fucking walk into the garden like you want it. And you know what I thought? It's a one-off. He'd write, fuck it. I goes, lads, I'll be back there in a sec. Up to my room, back into the tracksuit I came down by. The doors of the fucking... The lift opened, the lads were like nearly blinded. Fucking hell, what the lads, I said, I'll see you up there. I'm walking,
right?
I fucking walking down, and I walked down with a couple of guys.
Walk down 7th Avenue now,
yeah,
is it? Yeah,
down to Madison Square Garden, okay. Like, from the hotel, wasn't too far. So I walked down this fucking Ali G style tracksuit, like, you know, I say he wouldn't even wear it. And there's this other fella from Donegal, Mark Porter, and he said, it was a fucking, people start beeping the car, like, some people like, good luck or whatever. He said, do you ever think you see the day you're walking to Madison Square Garden and people are blowing their horns at you? You know, it was great.
Genuinely there, like, and you won that night, I know, and you won by knockout impressively that night. Like, when you look back at your career, I'm not going to say that's as good as it's going to get, because you may still become world champion yet. Like, but as you say, from Mahon to Madison Square Garden, walking down 7th Avenue in a flash tracksuit, going into the mecca of boxing in the world and knocking a guy out. How many boxes does that tick?
A lot. I feel very fortunate to have had that opportunity, and
But what is it about? Can you put your finger on what it is about Madison Square Garden?
Well, I suppose like it's just been so iconic, and there's so many events that were held there previous, like Muhammad Ali, Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield, all these great people. Like, and you only watched The Last Dance there recently on Netflix. Michael Jordan, what a great show! You know, I loved it.
Brilliant, yeah.
Oh, brilliant, yeah. So I suppose just the history that's there in New York is so spectacular. Like, it's a great place, and I suppose all of that, like.
What's the dressing rooms like there?
Oh, it was unbelievable, actually. You know, I felt like I was like a singer's there. Like, you'd expect something like a dressing room from Marilyn Monroe or something. Like, I remember the lights around the mirror, like. Yeah. You know, they were like something out of a carnival, you know, the big, massive plastic, big, huge lights you'd expect on a big wheel, on a Ferris wheel or something like that. Like, I never seen that in Leica. Yeah. Jeez. It was mad, like, it was great I feel very lucky, as I say.
Just even though it's not specific to the garden, Spike, one of the things I'm fascinated in, because obviously now with fights and TV and rights and everything like that, you do get access to the dressing room. There's always a camera in the dressing room. Now, obviously, you don't get to see everything in the dressing room. Like, you spoke earlier and we were talking about fear and adrenaline and how adrenaline can be a positive but can also be a negative like that. I'm presuming that's the most apprehensive hour, probably more even it is than when you get into the ring for a fighter, that thing before you break open the doors and head for the ring. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, it's definitely an apprehension, like you would. You'd be tense, like, and nervous of losing, like, definitely, would you? I think it's a pretty, it's a fairly unique in sport anyway, I think, like, you know. I suppose, like, it's not the end of the world, like, you know. I suppose there is more things you could be more anxious in life that are more important, like, you know, it's intense, you know.
Yeah. Do you ever look around at the people who are with you in the dressing room before a fight and then compare it to the people who are in the dressing room after a fight when you lose?
I've always had a good team, people that really care about me. That's what I love about my team, and I've been very loyal to them, and I never leave them. So my team have always been there for me. Win, lose, or draw, yeah, I've got a great team, and people that really cared about me, I've been very lucky that way, like, you know. Yeah. So I'm one of the fortunate ones. I've read books about other fellas that weren't so fortunate, you know, there's no one there.
The hangers the on.
Yeah, but not me. I've always had a good, very good team. Like, you know, my sponsor, Conal Thomas, actually, he goes to all my fights in America. Like, he's from Donegal originally, but lives in Cork longer than I believe. He's always been there, and my trainer, Pascal, is always there no matter what.
Okay, and your partner, does she?
Do you know what? She'd be very nervous. She'd be sick, like.
I can get that.
Nice to fight, so she doesn't go anymore, she doesn't watch anymore. She finds it very hard. You know, she'd be actually very, very nervous, and I think she feels, I think she throws up sometimes, and she actually rang me that time, actually, before the Fitzgerald fight. That's one thing that really fucking annoyed me, actually, as well, about him, like, and about the animosity and all that before the fight, and it was too much. But she was scheduled to come to Dublin for the fight, and, you know, she rang me. I always remember Disney was on, actually, in City West. It's a big event every year in City West Hotel, and we've actually went to a couple of times now with the kids, and it's brilliant, actually. But I love City West. I always stay there. I was there for years. All the staff are very good to me, very nice. Like, it's home for me now, like, so I know all the staff there. But I remember that morning, anyway, I was sat in traffic, kind of getting back into City West because of the Disney traffic, and she rang me. I always remember where I was, and she said, I can't come to the fight. I was expecting her up within hours, and she said, I said, why not? She said, I'm too nervous, I'm sick, I'm just after throwing up, can't come. I was pissed off and at him, Fitzgerald, and his team. You know,
But what was the difference with that one, Spike? Why did she feel, I mean, she literally physically threw up. So what was the difference there? Like, did she fear for your well-being?
Yeah. There was a lot of stuff exchanged on social media that went too far, you know, and it was within the country, it was in Dublin, and he's Irish, I'm Irish and all that, and you know, not too far away of a drive, and I think there was a lot of animosity and a lot of threats kind of through social media, that kind of thing, like that kind of shit, you know. So she's my partner, she's quiet, like she's not like that, like she wouldn't be kind of into that kind of, not that I'm into it myself either, like, but
does the fact that you are now a father make you a better fighter or a more desperate fighter?
A more determined fighter, you know. No, it just makes me more determined and to kind of keep going and provide for my kids, you know. I've managed to get to a point where I can provide for them very well now.
Good.
You know, so it gives me more determination. And, you know, since I was very young, since I was probably 11, was my real kind of time when I said I really want to be world champion. It was a dream, an actual dream. I was in Páirc Uí Chaoimh in 1995 watching Chris Eubank Sr. and Steve Collins, and
it was there, the
first professional fight I ever went to. Went to my dad and my brothers, we walked to it from Mahon where we live. But I remember this, like, I was 11, like, I was just about to embark on my amateur career officially as an 11-year-old, even though I had fought illegally at 9. I lied, I said I was 11, but I was very good, like, I was actually very good from a young age. And I actually remember I boxed the Welsh national champion. He was 11, I was 9. I beat him in a round in Swansea. You know, so, but yeah, I remember that, being in Páirc Uí Chaoimh and looking at the fight, and I was just saying, I wish that was me. Like, he was an Irishman, he beat was my favourite fighter, Chris Eubank Sr. Loved him. His
style, show, panache.
Yeah, brilliant. And he watched him fights again recently a couple of times during lockdown. Great, man, just great to watch. Like, fantastic, the one in Mill Street. And actually, funny enough, Chris Eubank Sr. sent me a message during the week asking me for a phone number. I'm still waiting to call me, though. I don't know what he wants. But, yeah, I loved him, though. He was the one that really got me into boxing, like, truly, from a young age. I thought he was great because I just loved watching wrestling as well. I just loved the wrestling. I said my brothers love it. And he reminded me more of a wrestler than a boxer. You know, his razzmatazz come with the ring, his showmanship. Great, you know, and I loved that.
Yeah, I loved that. There was this touch of that as well. The documentary that was on Virgin, Prize Fighter, which was really top, really good production now, I have to say. But there was a couple of times, especially when you had this somebody's flash suits on, I thought to myself, there's a little touch of McGregor. But now that you've mentioned it, there was a little touch of Eubank and the monocle, and you remember he used to have the cane all that kind of stuff, and the strut. And
I only put on the monocle to take the piss out of him, and I was winding up his son at the time. Yeah. You know, that's why I done that, making an angle and create the fight. But people say to me there, like, that no, like McGregor or whatever, like, what people don't realise is, as far as I know, I probably could correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure. I was like winning titles in boxing before UFC was ever even invented. So I've been wearing them suits ever before McGregor did.
Right.
So maybe he's one copy of me. No.
But what I did want to mention about the kids, Spike, is I would have thought that you become more vulnerable as a boxer when you have kids, on the basis of, well, I need to be around and I need to be healthy to father my kids, so you actually almost subconsciously, you know, become more protective of yourself. But not the case, you think?
I don't think you can have that mindset going into a fight. You have to be fully believe in yourself. And as I say, I always prepare very hard. Like, every time I ever go to a fight, I'm ready, you know. I'm very good. I've got a good defense. I don't get hit very much, you know. I don't look like a broke, busted up fighter, like, you know.
No.
And I've been boxing my entire life. Pascalov says that to me as well. I've only been cut in my last fight, actually, twice in my entire career. Most guys get cut far, far more than that, you know.
Sure.
I was cut once by a clash of heads, actually, and once legitimately by a good punch by Munguia.
Yeah.
You know,
You were 15-0 as a pro before you lost a fight.
Yeah.
Lost to Billy Joe Saunders. Talk to me about the psychological damage that a first defeat like that has on you, because 15-0 becomes, it's like anything, they say winning is a habit, and you had got into a very good habit, and then all of a sudden you're actually almost like stripped bare, you're fallible, you've been beaten. Does that damage you psychologically, Spike?
In that particular fight, I had a lot going on outside the ring, really. By not blaming that, like, I think Billy Joe Saunders is a better boxer than me anyway. He probably beat me anyway. He's a bigger man than me and more skillful. He's so poor. Good, very good fighter, very hard to beat. But I don't know, at that time I wasn't really thinking too clearly, and I said a lot of stuff going on outside the ring, and
boxing stuff, like, or life stuff?
Life stuff, yeah.
Oh yeah, okay.
And you know, my body was there, my brain was back in Cork.
Sure.
And then it was another life lesson for me. You know, you have to be right mentally for a fight. It's very important. If you're not mentally right, you might as well stay at home. But like, as I say, look, I'm not saying I would have beaten him anyway. He's a better boxer than me, and he's bigger and better. You know,
which of your four defeats that you've had, which is Saunders, Eubank, Lemieux and Mongoya, which is the one that left the bitterest aftertaste for you, for yourself?
Easily, Lemieux.
Sure.
Reason being is, contrary to what people are probably thinking, I'm going to say it, but a genuine fact is, out of them all, he's definitely the one I should have beaten. Mad to say it, like, even though, because it was the worst result of my career. I genuinely feel like I wouldn't be saying it, like, I wouldn't bother bullshitting, really, but I think he got lucky, like, that's the honest truth. I believe he got lucky.
Well, talk to us a bit about that, because that's in the documentary. I mean, you got absolutely caught with one over the top.
Yep.
You never saw it coming. It's a first round loss, and you're saying to yourself, and there had been a lot of talk in the build up to that fight as well.
I genuinely didn't like him as well. Very rare for myself, actually. I like most of my opponents, but I didn't like him at all. I've very good time for the majority of my opponents, like, you know.
Respect,
great. I've respect for him all. I've respect for him too, but I think he's a bit of an asshole, like. But you know, and I'd like to fight him again down the lane before I retire. I truly believe I'm a better fighter than him. I do believe he got lucky. I think, in fact, I go so far to say I think I would have ended his career that night. I think I'd have destroyed him, absolutely destroyed him.
So, and that, you know, must be a killer.
Well, it is, it was, like, I suppose I was going to go on to fight Canelo Alvarez or Golovkin, the winner of that, and I would have been getting probably minimum $5 million if I had beaten Lemieux, which was harder. That was kind of the worst part about it, really. But I got to buy a house for my family on that fight, so it wasn't all bad, you know. And but I was in the best condition of my career for that fight, I think. But I was light, very light.
He's
very heavy, but
but I think you're doing yourself a disservice there, because knowing a bit about the background to that fight, you had signed with Golden Boy, you had won the previous fight. As you said, this was the gateway to serious, serious money.
Yeah.
You were looking at, as you say, Canelo, you're looking at Golovkin, you were looking at, as you say, you were looking at millions after that. I think you were very confident going into the fight. I think you felt yourself that you could beat him. So the shock of actually just being caught, I'm trying to think of a comparison to other sports, and you're saying to yourself there isn't one, because it's all done and dusted in 90 seconds.
Yeah, that's right. 150 seconds.
Was it more? Sorry, it was, okay, 150.
Careful, Tony. But sure, look, it is what it is, you know. That's boxing, you know. But like, Lemieux was a very hard puncher, and one of the pound-for-pound hardest punchers in the sport, and his weight difference as well was
huge.
It was a factor. And but sure, look.
Why would you? What has your confidence? Is it a style thing that you feel like if you got him again, you'd be able to set aside the weight, the everything?
I'm a better boxer than him, and I just beat him. You know, I felt as though the fight was going good until then. I felt like he was puffing already, because he'd struggled to make weight so hard. He was already puffing, and I'd spoke Billy Joe Saunders, who'd absolutely destroyed him in Quebec that night, when I probably had my biggest win of my career that night in Quebec. Saunders just told me, just be careful, he's got wicked power, but if you go beyond five rounds, he's absolutely
Gone.
Fucked, yeah. He's gone. He blows.
Blows a gasket.
Yeah, yeah. And I seen him preparing for the Billy Joe Saunders. As I say, I seen him crawling out of the sauna like a bloody slug. Mm-hmm. He couldn't even get up. He crawled and he got up onto the side of a sauna. So he was being knackered for making weight. Like, and it was the same against me. And actually, in fact, worse, I'd say, because it was sometime after that time we'd fought in Quebec. He actually, in fact, the fight after he fought me, he tried to make middle, but again, he collapsed. He was brought by ambulance to hospital. He struggled to make weight so much. He never again boxed a middleweight after he fought me. Mm. I think he actually boxed a super middleweight, the division above, and he struggled to make weight again.
Mm.
You know, so he's too big for the division, like, really.
The fight you had after Lemieux, I'm trying to think of it myself, actually. I know you won, but the opponent isn't actually key in this fight. What I was going to ask you is...
I remember now, actually. I was against Gabriel Garbix.
That's right, yeah.
In Mayo, great crack actually. He actually dressed up as Peter Kay and came out to me. This is the way at Amarillo. Good crack in Mayo. Good night. Yeah, it was just the area man wasn't the same level fighter I am. Basically, and it was just a kind of a comeback fight.
Yeah, because the question, I mean, we're going back there a few minutes, and you're talking about post the Fitzgerald fight, and you actually drop him with, as you say, the knockout of the year, and Eddie Hearn is talking about you, and De La Hoya is knocking at your door, and everything. The flip side is Spike versus Lemieux. Everything is going fine. And then is it almost like you're then basically out of the picture, off the radar, afterwards, in terms of, you know, pairing you up for the big bouts? It's like snakes and ladders, Spike, isn't it? You just drop all of a sudden.
Yeah, great comparison, Tony. Yeah, you're spot on. Yeah, that's exactly it. But yeah, I will say Golden Boy Promotions have been very good to me, and I have a very good relationship with them. And they said immediately after the fight that they didn't believe the better fighter won, and that I think they're right. I agree. You know. Like I said, Billy Joe Saunders is a better boxer than me, but Lemieux is not. And they said that they had no intention of kicking me to the curb, and that they had every intention of bringing me back, you know, to fight again, which they did, against Mungi. And also this fight I had with Mungi, I had a 3-fight contract at junior middleweight because I wanted to try and become the world champion at junior middleweight.
At 154,
That they said, when I agreed to fight Mungi, that contract was ripped up again, therefore I had a 1-fight contract with Munguia. But they said they had no intention of getting rid of me as well after that, and that they'll give me back my junior middleweight contract. They'll give me a new one again.
Okay.
Spike, this has the potential to be the longest podcast in history. It's a podcast restarted in 2020 for all sorts of reasons, lockdown being the main one. We're finishing it in 2021, but it's actually very timely that we're hooking up again, because you announced the fact that you are getting back in the ring in Brussels. So given that, you know, the most famous word in our dictionary at the moment seems to be roadmaps, talk to me about the 2021 roadmap for Spike O'Sullivan.
Well, first of all, as you said, we're back to Belgium. I was there recently doing a bit of commentary in a few fights, and I'm going to travel out there again at the end of this month. And hopefully I get a win there and get back on the horse and back to winning ways, and you know, just try and lay myself up for the world championship. Like that has always been my intention.
And as listeners will hear over the course of this special interview, you're 37 in July, but you actually believe you're a better boxer now, physically and intelligence-wise, than you ever were. And I think from talking to you, you still firmly believe that a world title is very much within your compass.
Oh, without doubt. And you know, Tony, I'm very glad to inform you, I feel even better now than I did the last time I spoke to you. Through the lockdown, I've been training away, continuing to train and doing lots of weights, and I feel stronger than ever, and my running times have improved. I'm the best runner that I ever was, and I used to hate running, but you know, I put on a lot of weight as well, going back in probably the first lockdown, and out of necessity, I had to take up a lot of running, like, to try and get the weight back down. It was a mammoth task, and it was tough, you know, it was mentally very daunting, but I I took it on, and as I progressed through time, actually I got a condition, a plantar fasciitis during it, which kind of hindered me for a bit. I had to take about 6 weeks out, but I got new footwear and I got a foot massage machine that ratified that, and I'm back running since then, and I'm starting to enjoy my running more than ever, and I'm doing the best times I've ever done and the longest distances, and I just think my all-round game is continuing to get better and better.
Just give us a little sense. I know obviously these things are very much up in the air, and more often than not at the behest of promoters and opponents and that kind of stuff, but just give me a sense of how you'd like your 2021 calendar to actually roll out.
Well, first of all, I've got to look at this fight and, you know, hopefully get the win there, as you say. I'm looking forward to that, and I'll be aiming towards the world title. Hopefully that's what I'd like to achieve within the year before this Christmas. I'd like to become champion of the world, and that's my intention, and I'm going to do my utmost to achieve that. I'm looking forward to the trip to Belgium. Really nice people out there. The last time I was out there, we were in a place called Charleroi, which is deemed the ugliest city in the world, which I wouldn't agree at all with. No, it's a good place, but you know, we're going to fight in Liège, I think, this time. So that's great. I love that. Just new experiences in different parts of the world, and you know, getting to travel around, and you know, I look forward to it.
And you're confident you'll make 154 for the fight?
Yeah, I'm very confident. I'll make it. Yeah, it's a bit of a task, you know, but I believe I will get there. Yeah.
If you make 154. You're going to bring that extra power to that division, and I presume that extra degree of confidence.
Without doubt, yeah. I've never been beaten at 154 pounds. I've only been beaten at 160 pounds on four occasions, and they were by four world champions. So I'm very, very confident that I have 154, that I can beat anybody.
I mean, again, I know these things are arbitrary in terms of decision, but you say like that by the end of the year, you want to be fighting for a world title. Do you think that can really happen realistically, or do you think you're going to have to fight again to achieve that?
I think I may have to fight again prior to fighting for a world title to achieve that. But I think it's realistic that I could fight for the world title before the end of the year. But I have a very positive mindset, and it wouldn't faze me if I don't. I believe it's my destiny to become world champion, and you know, it's my intention to fight for maybe another 7 years. I'd like to serve 20 years as a professional boxer, and I believe I continue to get better all the time. And as I say, I'm probably fitter than ever right now, and I believe the best is yet to come. I truly believe that.
I mean, genuinely, Spike, from the outside, my concern looking at anybody that isn't just a boxer is ring rustiness. I mean, you know yourself, you know your way about around the ring better than anybody, but when you haven't fought, and you haven't fought, I'm presuming since January 2020, if I'm right, like, there has to be a concern about ring rustiness.
Yeah, there probably is. You know, it has been 16 months. It is the longest I've ever been out of the ring in my whole career. So, but I've been in the gym sparring about the past maybe 9 weeks. I helped one of the lads prepare for his fight. You know, and I've been continuing to spare, and I will be up until this fight. And I've got a wealth of experience. I've had 34 professional fights. I've been boxing for 31 years. And, you know, it's like I feel very at home and relaxed in the ring, and I feel good.
You've gone all over the world fighting. I mean, as you said yourself, from Mahon to Madison Square Garden, you've fought in Texas. You've spent a year at home. It's been, as you said, probably the most enjoyable year of your life in many respects, in terms of with your kids and your partner. And how do you actually get back the appetite then, Spike, to get back in the ring when you've actually got used, do you know what I mean, to those family comforts?
Well, I really enjoyed that year. I really, really loved it. But, you know, to provide for my kids, it's my job as well at the end of the day. So, you know, I got to earn some crust and get some money, more money in the bank. And, you know, so, and if I can achieve what I want to achieve, it'll give them more comfortable life. So that's where I find my motivation, you know, to gain some money, basically, and try and achieve my goal as well on top of that. But just to provide for my family is the main thing, I suppose.
Okay, and just to give boxing fans a sense of where the division is at, you know, Mongia was your last fight. I mean, and obviously that's at 160. So, you know, who is the man to beat at 154, and how does the path for Spike O'Sullivan lead there?
Well, the guy I was aiming at initially was Patrick Teixeira. He's been since beaten by the Argentinian Brian Castano. I believe now Brian Castano is going to have a unification match with Charlo from New York, Jermall Charlo, and therefore one of those guys could have every belt in the division. So I'll be aiming for maybe the winner of that fight. And as I said, I've never been beaten at 154 pounds. I've competed at the highest level at 160. Therefore, I'm very confident that I can beat anybody in the world at 154.
Right. So take me forward to, say, next Christmas, maybe January, Las Vegas, light middleweight championship of the world. Explain to me, just as somebody who's interested in this kind of stuff, what does the actual build up, what does the camp actually look like? Give us an idea. How many times a day do you train in that situation? Are you tapering it off closer to the fight? Just give us an insight, Spike, into that kind of stuff.
Well, there again, no true experience. I believe I can train better than I ever did. I've played around with all different sorts of things through my career and tried to see what worked best. I went mad there one time and training like 5 times a day, you know, for fights, and I think that was a bit too much, you know. I'd say twice a day, I know, is the right amount of time to train, like, for me.
Early morning? Like, is how much of a space
yeah,
between?
Yeah, I could do early mornings for a run there, now twice a week, say, and maybe not as early other mornings, and, you know, and I only started doing weight in 2014. I think they were very beneficial to me, my strength, like, you can see your strength increasing significantly as you consistently lift the weights, you know, and I think psychologically that's it's a great boost, you know, to know you're legitimately getting stronger, like, for a fact.
I mean, there's a skill in that, like, getting yourself to a point where you're just there.
There is, and not to peak too soon, and having the right length of training camp, and, you know, being psychologically happy as well, like, you know, being in a good frame of mind.
Yeah.
I like to stay at home and train in Dublin because I like to see my kids and my partner every weekend.
Sure.
You know, but you have, I hate being away, but it's a necessity to be away, you know, for the 5 days of the week anyway. Because if you're home, you'll, no matter what you say, if you say, oh no, I have to go to the gym, I'm at work basically, but never work like that, you'll always end up doing a school run or, you know, doing something. Whereas you need to be, you know, shut off from all that, you just need to train, like. So.
And could you retire financially now?
Well, I bought a house, I've no mortgage, like, I suppose, like, you know, I could just go and work and do a normal job. Like, I'm a sheet metal worker by trade as well. I won't go back to it. I don't think it's the best for your health. But, like, I'm not, I feel like I could do any job. Like, I wouldn't mind. Like, I actually like talking to people. I always thought McDonald's looked like a good job. I always see the people there. They seem like they're having good banter and cracking. Remind me when I was working. I worked a lot of jobs, actually, myself. Growing up, I started working early. I started working when I was 14. Never liked school, like, you know. I always found myself looking out the window of school, just wanting to go out and play a ball, like, curling or something, like, go to the boxing room or play soccer. Fuck, I just didn't like school. Like, just wasn't for me, unfortunately. I wish it was. You know, I'd recommend to everybody to do the Leaving Cert. Like, I didn't do the Leaving Cert. I left, but I regret it. But at the time, I just didn't have time for it. I didn't like it, like. You know, but I went working in the butchers in Super Value when I was 14, and from there to Texaco, down Mahanskia Road there, working there for a few months. I worked in Lidl, and where else did I work? Then I done my train after that. I worked in a tile centre as well before that.
Okay. You know, so, look, everybody, obviously, you're very well known in Cork and Ireland, and I think that there's actually quite a bit of pride about you in Cork. I mean, you know, Cork people about their own.
Yeah.
They're actually really, like, but I mean, do you ever actually run into, like, trouble? You know, because let's face it, there's always going to be assholes out there want a little bit of a rub off Spike O'Sullivan in the pub. And, oh, yeah, you know what I mean? I mean, do you have the facility and the ability just to laugh at that and walk away? Or is the nature of the beast kind of like, you know, go away now or you'll regret it?
Sure. We came upon lots of lots of that over the years, like, but sure, but not much anymore. No, I think I'm fairly well established, and people respect me, and they like me, like, they don't want to fight me, like, you know, I find, you know.
I wonder why.
I know, sure, like, there's plenty of bigger fellas out there than me, and, you know, these days there's loads of fellas into wrestling and all that. I'm sure one of them could choke me out there some night, like, you know, but no, people respect me, they like me, I think, and I always get that, you know, feeling when I'm around Cork City, and if I ever go for a few drinks, like, you know, nearly all the bears, they nearly always give you a pint and all that, like,
yeah.
I find it's always, it's very nice, actually. I had a friend there, no, I wouldn't mention his name, but we were walking down the street there one day, like, years, a few years ago now, like, before I got the money to get my house and all that, like, I didn't have much myself at all, like, and he said to me, like, he had a couple of houses, like, no mortgages, and he'd a few million in the bank as well, and we were walking down Patrick Street, and a load of people saying hello to you, like, and he said to me, he goes, and then no spike, he said, I'd fucking swap you by all my houses, my millions in the bank for that, he goes, you can't buy that.
Mm. That's true. Respect.
Yeah, he's right. It's true, like. I feel very happy now. I'm not loaded, like, but I have a house and for my family, and I have a grand car, like, and I'm happy out, like.
Has The Rock ever been in the ring, tell me? You mentioned The Rock.
Darn, I mean, it. Jeez, I don't
he
know.
He strikes me as a guy who'd be able to take care of himself in the ring.
Oh, he said that. He said he would, yeah. Definitely. Actually, he beat me in an arm wrestling match one night. Great crack. We were inside now. Where was it again? Next to Cubans there years ago. What was it called? It was a bar next to Cubans. It's not the same bar anymore. But
right.
Inside the pub anyway.
Cubans hasn't been around in a while, yeah.
No, it was alongside the Cubans. I can't remember. It was kind of the side bar off Cubans. But it was a night there, a league of their own, Cork style, you know. Great crack now. I think John McHale from the Echo was actually...
Oh, yeah, MCing.
MCing it. And it was Dermot anyway. He was in the opposing team to me. I think, you know, Tony O'Donoghue, Cork.
RT,
I was with him. I'm with his team, and I can't remember who else was there, but Dermot anyway was in the other team. But bollocks at the end anyway, it was a draw officially, so they said they have to finish it off with an arm wrestling match, so it's a team member from each team, like, sure, fuck's sake, Dermot weighed me by about 7 stone, the fucker. he beat me anyway.
And you were able to show your face after that?
I know.
But did you play Ga, tell me? Did you actually?
I did. I only played Ga there recently again.
With what club would you be with?
Ballinor, I played for there recently. But I played for the Bears, I played for Crays 3, you know, my school. But recently there, I was going into Mahon Pine Shopping Centre. And my friend there, he'd be kind of a selector down below in Ballinor, like. And I don't know how long ago, 2-3 years ago, I said, not sure. But I was walking to me, he goes, come here, we're stuck for a few players there tonight. Playing down West Cork or something.
It's a football.
Football. Yeah. He goes, Junior B, no way. I said, well, fucking grand. I will, yeah, not a bother. I ring me all that. I said, listen, I'm going playing a Gaelic football match there anyway. Oh, fucking great crack. Got into the team bus down to West Cork, and but there was a photographer from the Examiner, actually, matter of fact. I got to suss
that one out.
Nope.
Where did you play? I'm guessing full forward.
I did, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, you'd be a good man to win a ball, I'd
score,
say.
Yeah, or at that level anyway, you would like to be much fitter than him, like. But, there was some photographer in the crowd and he took a picture of the bollocks. Oh, for fuck's sake, the next day I was in the Examiner and I get a call from Pascal.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, what the fuck's going on down there? You're playing football.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez, I said, well, I totally know that. I was in the Examiner. I played a hurling match then the following week. I actually got 4 goals in the match. No, shocking level again, like, but I was fairly good at sport, like. And I had to come off injured. I had a chunk out of my bloody shin. Actually, took the full out of the skin off, all the hair on the skin. I could see my shin bone. But my thumbs were swollen out badly. I was out of the gym for a while over it.
You got to keep away from that hurling.
I'll never play hurling again over it, like. Yeah. But at that level, though, you get more injuries, like. Yeah. You know, fellas are fucking just swinging, like, aimlessly, like.
I'm thinking back, just to finish, to that 9-year-old kid. You said something there which I thought to myself, whoa, you were 9, you were in Swansea, you were beating an 11-year-old local kid. That, can you even remember, Spike, that time thinking to yourself, you know what, I must be pretty decent at this stuff?
Oh, I knew I was decent. Sure, I was in the gym sparring all national champions in Ireland at the time. I was 9. The boys were 11 and 12, like, you know, up in the Glen. I actually got, funnily enough, I have a bit of a cauliflower there, and I got that at the age about 9 from a fella about 11 or 12, you know, national champion. It was hard sparring, like, at the time. It's there, it's still there, like, there for life, I suppose. But You know, I was very physically strong, and you know, I knew I could fight, like, you know.
I guess the last thing I'll say to you, I'm thinking about that Virgin Media program and the prize fighter, and there was a scene in it where you're inside in a swimming pool, you have a drink in your hand, you're after winning, life is good, and you're thinking to yourself, you know, like, it doesn't get much better than this. And you mentioned the Madison Square Garden thing, and then the very next fight, I think, was the Lemieux fight.
Yeah,
it
was.
So it's the difference, isn't it? The highs and lows of boxing. There can't actually almost be another sport like it.
Yeah, you're right. The highs and lows are incredible. A lot of guys find it very hard after boxing, you know. I don't think it's even possible. I really and truly don't think it's actually possible at all to get a emulate the highs, you know. So a lot of them struggle after boxing. Like,
mentally.
You know, mentally, yeah, too. Because, like, the ring walks, like, I actually watched the Eubank fight there again recently in the O2 in London. Like, you know, 20,000 people, magnificent arena. You know, I grew up watching on TV, and to be actually there doing it was a bit surreal. Actually, that particular fight was surreal because I grew up watching his father, Eubank Sr., on the TV with my father. And I always remember the chants of Eubank, Eubank. You know, it was brilliant. It's what I grew up with, and I loved it. And you know, when I fought him, it was a bit surreal. It was the only time ever, actually, in my whole career that I ever kind of lost my trail of thought in the fight. When I heard the crowd, thousands of them, Eubank, Eubank, you know, Englishman against an Irishman in London, bound to happen. Do you know what it was like? It was like being on the couch with my dad at home, watching, looking at the telly, fucking in the ring. Like, it brought me back to being on the couch with my dad watching the fights. Just, you know, really did.
Spike, thanks a million for the chat.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me in.